The Movements is a left-wing history and politics podcast. Subscribe on Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod. Today I'm joined again by Adam Patterson, analyst of armed conflict specializing in civil war, insurgency, and extremist movements. You can find his work at currentaffairs.org and his blog, napalminthemorning.com. He joined me today to offer his insights on an underappreciated aspect of the political situation in Gaza, the Salafist political rivals to Hamas. Before we begin, a quick show note. You might hear some strange noises in the background while I'm talking. That would be veggie chips that Adam was munching on. The Skype calls are recorded into a single track, so I tried my best to minimize the crackling noises, but they're there. So, you know, fuck you, Adam. And now we begin the latest installment of Stalin for Time. Thanks for coming back on the show, Adam. So before we begin, I just wanted to run briefly through the history of the last 10, 15 years or so of the Gaza situation for audience who might not actually be very familiar with what's been going on. So obviously, the history shows that I've been working on. There's a big gap between then and where this situation begins. So just briefly, the Gaza Strip, it's a tiny little piece of land. The Palestinian territories separate from the West Bank. It was under occupation by the Israelis for several decades. And then after the Second Intifada, Israeli policy shifted and they removed their settlers from Gaza and then basically just kind of kept it closed off entirely. In 2006, there are elections in which Hamas, which is considered a terrorist organization by the United States, EU, and several other countries, wins the elections, which embarrasses the hell out of George W. Bush, who had been spending the last couple of years talking about democracy in the Middle East and how great elections are. So at which point the EU, the US, and Israel slap sanctions and impose a blockade, just immediately begin trying to topple them. So 2007, Mohamed Dahlan, who is a longtime security guy within Fatah, within the PLO and Palestinian Authority later on, he, with U.S. backing, U.S. money, and U.S. weapons, starts getting ready to overthrow Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Gaza Strip is where, in the 90s, he was the security chief under the Palestinian Authority and gained a reputation for being into torturing Hamas members and funneling money into his own bank account. So 2007 comes along, Hamas figures out what's going on, and they preempt the coup. There's several days of very, very bloody fighting between Hamas and Fatah members. And then at the end of the day, Hamas wins. And the next, I guess, up to 10 years, it's basically been a pattern in which Israel continues to maintain a blockade of supplies, of food, of all kinds of materials on Gaza while trying to pressure Hamas and the population into overthrowing Hamas or Hamas collapsing or something along those lines. You have had on and off again conflicts that are usually minor violations on the Palestinian side or major violations on the Israeli side. Usually they, you know, there's a couple of trade tit for tat, nothing ends up happening. But there have been three major conflicts during this time. CAS led in 2008 and 2009, Israel launches a raid about a few weeks before the big fighting starts. They kill six Hamas militants. This pisses off a whole lot of the Palestinian factions in Gaza. Hamas, which has been trying to maintain a ceasefire that mostly held for the past 6 months, they aren't able to keep all the factions in line, and a lot more rocket attacks start happening, and Israel uses this as the pretext to launch an air and ground assault that ends up killing about 800 to 900 Palestinian civilians. During the fighting, Palestinian rockets kill about three Israeli civilians, and then for a while, the status quo continues. The blockade remains. There's occasional rocket fire that usually has no major consequence, followed by Israel blowing up a building or two here, and then Israel continuing to do things such as firing on fishermen, things like that. Pillar Defense comes along in 2012. Israel starts out by assassinating Ahmed Jaberi, who is a Hamas member who is in charge of enforcing the truces along the different factions and was in the process of trying to establish a permanent long-term truce. They start the operation by killing him and launch an air assault, no ground assault this time. Israel, during the course of the fighting, loses about 4 civilians. The Palestinians in Gaza lose about 100. And then status quo continues. Same song as before. Protective Edge comes along in 2014. This was a particularly rough and bloody situation. 3 Israeli settler teenagers are kidnapped. And then while searching for the teenagers, Israel proceeds to arrest 700 Palestinians, ransacks a whole bunch of universities and other offices and things like that. And then some rockets start firing from Gaza, and then they use this as the pretext to launch a massive assault that put the other two to shame. They destroy, just wipe out a whole ton of Gaza's infrastructure, a bunch of their buildings, their facilities, hospitals, mosques, all sorts of things. By the end of it, there are about 1,600 to 1,700 Palestinian civilians dead and 5 Israeli civilians who have been killed. And since then, it's been relatively quiet on the Gaza front, not so much in other parts of Israel and Palestine, but in Gaza, neither side has really wanted or been ready to start another war. The Palestinians in the Gaza side of things, they're exhausted. They've just gone through 3 wars in just a short period of time. The infrastructure is still being rebuilt, and it's going to take forever. It's moving at a snail's pace. And on the Israeli side of things, they were not expecting the level of resistance that they received in 2014. The Palestinian militants from the different factions, including Hamas, put up a fight that they just weren't expecting and exacted a significant toll on the IDF. The IDF historically doesn't actually like to take very many casualties. No army really does, but Israel in particular, their military forces, they like to look strong, but the second things actually get a little tough on them, it tends to change their tune on things a little bit. So they also suffered a major PR disaster. It hurt them on the international stage. Amongst American public opinion, there's been a massive shift towards Palestine solidarity movement and against the Israeli government over the past 7 or so years, especially after Protective Edge, after the last conflict there. So that's been the situation. Currently, in the last few weeks, things have developed pretty rapidly. The Palestinian Authority has been trying to cut off energy supplies to Gaza in order to exacerbate the situation even more, in order to get Gaza to give in to the Palestinian Authority's demands. Over the past 10 years, the two have been trying to reconcile here and there, but it's none of the attempts have lasted very long and been very successful, and there haven't been new elections either for the Palestinian Legislative Council in the last decade plus. And at the same time, Hamas is getting desperate. Their military capabilities are not what they used to be. They've become more and more unpopular every year, despite their claims to have won the last few conflicts. It's just devastated both the Palestinians themselves as well as Hamas's political infrastructure and their prestige. Meanwhile, you have small, tiny, otherwise marginal groups of Salafists who are becoming more politically active and forming militias of their own. they have been responsible for many of the isolated rocket attacks that have been happening. Every, you know, couple of months, there will be a single rocket that flies, lands usually in the middle of nowhere of no consequence. Israel goes in and attacks Hamas targets. Israel has a policy of holding Hamas responsible for anything that comes from Gaza. And it's created a situation where the Salafists can do whatever they want and they don't really have to pay a price. Instead, their rivals, Hamas, are the ones that pay the price. Hamas, for their part, has been on and off again trying to come to some sort of agreement with the Salafist groups, who, again, are fairly small and otherwise marginal, but have been gaining politically over these last few years. There have been times when Hamas has straight up conducted mass arrests and raids and killed a bunch of the Salafist group's members. And I should note that there are several of these small groups. They're not one monolith of these Salafist groups. And then other times when they've cut deals with them, basically saying, like, you guys can engage in religious and cultural activities, basic political organizing, but you do not challenge us. You do not fire rockets. You do not do anything that can threaten our power. It's been quite a situation there. And there's also Salafists active in the West Bank and in Israel proper, although there seems to be a big question over how powerful and numerous they actually are. Because these are, when it comes to pure numbers, there are not very many of them. Historically, that sort of side of the Islamist political spectrum doesn't really have a whole lot of sway amongst Palestinians, but there's a concern that this could change in the future. So anyway, to get to you, Adam, my question that I had for you, since this is kind of your wheelhouse, is I wanted to start out by, if you could explain what Salafism is, specifically Salafist jihadism, what the different disagreements amongst these different groups are, both in the, you know, the Palestinian context or in the wider context across the world, and are they, as Israel claims, to be the same thing as Hamas?
Yeah, I can take it from here. To put it gently, are Hamas and various Salafi jihadist groups the same? Not in the least. The ideology and origins are pretty radically different. If I can sort of give a breakdown, both contemporary political Islamism and Salafi jihadism are both entirely different movements, but also have a relatively modern character. Salafi jihadism in particular is a modern movement that, I don't mean Salafism as a religious movement, I mean violent Salafi jihadism, has its origins in the seed of the Afghan jihad, which occurred during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which was, again, horrifically brutal, caused mass fracture of Afghan society without historical precedent, and also allowed various bin Laden-led groups, Arab groups, to begin to filter into Afghanistan and to take basically refuge there in the aftermath. And while, to backpedal a little bit, while Islamic revivalism and Islam as ideological opposition to liberalism and modernity began to merge in, say, the late 1800s and early 1900s, Salafism, Salafi jihadism, is something that's only really been inseminated in the past 30 years or so as any sort of serious presence in the global ideological and militant stage. To go back to Islamism, the first ideologues of modern Islamism only began to start publish in serious volumes and sort of at a serious pace around the 1940s or so. They really had their seeds in Egypt. Sayyid Qutb, who pushed back against regimes they perceived as insufficiently Islamic, were sort of the progenitors of this. Salafism kind of emerged. The history is a bit murky here, and Salafis will sometimes take offense at being compared to Wahhabis. But Salafism kind of was born somewhat after the preaching and writings of Abdul al-Wahhab, who sort of preached up and down the Arabic or sort of Saudi Arabian peninsula. And to get down to the difference between these two, Islamism is something that is, at least in the Western and American imagination, most closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, who, of course, affiliates with Hamas. And Islamists believe that a traditionalist understanding of Islam can be instituted through an electoral system, democracy, or political participation of some form. Even like Turkey's Recep Erdogan is an Islamist. And you will see Islamists actively and passionately involved in politics, in, again, electoral processes. And if you see the way in which they conduct themselves publicly, the signals are very telling. They tend to dress in modern attire. They favor suits, neatly trimmed facial hair, mustaches or beards, nothing like what you'd see in a Salafi jihadist. And they even wear, like, what would be considered, in some circles, flashy accessories, like watches or ties. Salafis, on the other hand, and keep in mind that Salafi jihadism is only a small fraction of the world's Salafis. Salafism is particularly popular among Arab Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates. Salafis, if you look at the way they dress, as a precept of this, they tend to favor robes, long hair, and untrimmed beards. And Salafism is best put as they're described as a hyper-reactionary form of Sunni Islam that centers, in a broad sense, much of its precepts on following what they imagine to be the purity of belief and practice espoused by the Prophet Muhammad and his immediate followers and the first generation of converts. The belief is that this is the only true, in their rendering, only true practice and understanding of Islam, and any schools of thought or interpretations in the aftermath are perversions or at best stray from what was handed down to the Prophet Muhammad from God himself. And unlike Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood or Hamas, Salafis are generally apolitical or view democracy or political participation as beneath them or a distraction from the true practice and exercise of Islam. And Salafis tend to focus much more on preaching or dawah, and do so through social or tribal networks, and hold that as the true calling of devout Muslim. And within these, a minority of Salafis are what, again, we call Salafi jihadis. And unlike Salafis in general, these Salafi jihadis believe that the only way to bring about the pure and true practice of Islam is through violent struggle or insurrection that results in the creation of a pan-Sunni Muslim caliphate that mimics flawlessly the behavior and conduct of how they see the Prophet Muhammad to have acted. And by their rendering, armed struggle and even severe brutality is righteous or correct as long as it results in the creation of a caliphate that basically internalizes the practice of true Islam and drives out heretics, non-believers, liberals, modernists, etc. Salafi jihadi groups, as I said, didn't really start achieving serious eminence until the 1990s. Again, this is after Osama bin Laden had success in Germany in the movement in Afghanistan. And it is, again, like Salafism itself had its sort of origins within Arab societies. And typically what happens with Salafi jihadi groups is they believe in utilizing national fracture or social disillusion and taking a power vacuum or security vacuum and exacerbating that to make territorial gains and therefore try to set up or assert some sort of region that they can rule as the beginning of a caliphate. And areas where sort of jihadis of some sort have managed to capture territory in recent years include Afghanistan, Chechnya, and most recently Libya, Iraq, and Syria. And again, these are all places with a heavy history of national fracture or warfare that is very easy for opportunistic and extremist groups to exploit. And typically what happens in modern practice is if there is an area where a Salafi jihadi affiliate can exploit as a place of eminence, they will oftentimes travel there in large numbers. You've seen this in Iraq and Syria, where the respective civil wars of both states have allowed ISIS to emerge and have also allowed Al-Qaeda affiliates like Jabhat al-Nusra to basically set up shop. And you'll see when they do, you'll have young men will travel from across the world, typically drawn by the siren call of jihadism, to fight in these theaters. You see it heavily from Chechnya, for example, Tunisia. And this is the goal, particular to Salafi jihadis, of using violence to carve out some degree of territorial eminence and put into more direct practice their vision of building some sort of hyper-fundamentalist caliphate. And something that I think is sort of keen to point out and is very important to point out about Salafis is typically when you'll hear pundits in America sort of shoot their mouth off about this sort of stuff, they refer to them as radical Islamists. And I don't think that's semantically all that accurate, because radicalism is typically something that has never been done before, or a social change or political change that is completely novel and a break with tradition. Women's suffrage was radical, for example. You can sort of describe all sorts of movements as radical if they have no precedent. Salafi jihadi movements are hyper, hyper reactionary in the sense that they believe that the best way to live is a mimicry in their conception of the way Islam was practiced in like the 700s, if that makes sense. And with this, to get down to the various factions within Salafi jihadism, as I've mentioned, the two biggest practitioners and groups are Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And there was recently been a split between the two factions. ISIS emerged from Al-Qaeda in Iraq as its sort of progenitor or parent organization. And ISIS, in contrast to Al-Qaeda, ISIS emphasizes heavily that brutality, shock, and even violence against the local population is necessary under the justification that it might cause a caliphate to emerge. Al-Qaeda, of course, is, in their own right, clearly violent, hyper-sectarian, and capable of, you know, armed brutality against, you know, for example, Shia Muslims and others who in no way deserve it. But they tend to favor a more gradual approach that focuses on securing territory and potentially winning the allegiance or at least acceptance of the locals. And that's sort of one of the big differences even between those two. There could be a lot of, for example, jihadi groups tend to be very fractious. They can emerge spontaneously in regions. They can split from each other. They can turn on each other. And that's kind of what it comes down to. And you're absolutely right that Salafi jihadism has typically not been particularly popular in Palestine for two reasons. The first of which is that the Palestinians have historically seen their struggle and their cause as something that is particular to the Palestinians, and they want it to remain their own. They don't want too much meddling from the outside. And also because Hamas is, as I mentioned, are Islamists, but they are not Salafis, and the two do not get along. For example, the Muslim Brotherhood is seen as heretical by you know, ISIL affiliates, for example, who exist throughout Sinai and Egypt. And that's, to put a bow on it, that's kind of the general spiel on the difference between Islamism and Salafi jihadism, and what Salafi jihadism looks like nowadays.
You answered my leading question wonderfully.
Thank you.
What I find fascinating about this conflict is, so, you know, if I read Haaretz, El Monitor, and a couple of other like Middle Eastern focused news outlets in English, and even Times of Israel and Jerusalem Post have talked about this conflict between Hamas and with the Salafist groups in Gaza. They don't go into a whole lot of detail, but they'll, anytime there's a major development, like, you know, a raid or a wave of mass arrests by Hamas of the Salafists, it'll be a news item. And yet it never makes it into the wider analysis of what's going on there. And the difference between, so as you mentioned earlier, the differences between like an ISIS and an Al-Qaeda, you could argue that those, it's an example of organizations with similar end goals, but very different means. And that's where the splinter comes from. Versus organizations like Hamas and the Salafist groups in Gaza, they really don't have the same end goal. They do, I mean, which is not to say that Hamas is not reactionary and right-wing in its own way, but what they are calling for, as well as the reality of what goes on in Gaza today, as conservative as it is, does not even come close to what the goals of the Salafists are attempting to do. I think you could also argue that a lot of Hamas's policies that have been fairly religious fundamentalists in the last few years have been in response to the Salafists vying for influence and trying to appease more conservative elements in Gazan society. Because at the same time, Hamas has, and this is controversial to say, even though it's the record, Hamas has been moderating for the past, basically since the end of the Second Intifada, even going so far as to, about 2 months ago or so, releasing a brand new charter and de facto recognizing Israel. They don't go out and say that they recognize Israel, but they accept a two-state solution, and more or less a two-state solution that's more or less in consensus with that of Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, who Israel considers the representative of the Palestinian people and the people you're supposed to negotiate with. And what's interesting is Israel's policy for the past decade has been to try to topple Hamas. And now it seems like they are maybe a little bit more self-aware or aware of the possibility of, well, if Hamas collapses in Gaza, which is not unreasonable to think that that could happen, considering how much of a crisis Gaza has been going through and continues to go through, what comes after that? Particularly given, as you say, Salafist jihadist groups, and I don't actually know that the groups in Gaza are even close to that sort of level of extremism. But the concern that this is kind of their MO is to go into areas that are undergoing major collapses or going through utter chaos and using that to their advantage. So, for example, just a few days ago, there was another rocket launch from Gaza, although this one might not have been by Salafists this time. But the point is that Israel attacked a few Hamas areas in Gaza, but in the past they tend to do, you know, try to exert some pain. It seems like they're attacking less like softer targets, if that's the right term. I might be using the jargon incorrectly here, I apologize, than they have been before. Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister, even in the fall of last year, while reiterating their policy of no negotiation with Hamas and no ending the blockade until Hamas has been toppled, Avigdor Lieberman quietly sort of at the same time admitted that toppling Hamas is not a realistic goal in the short term, which is a significant difference from what their policy had been for the past 10 years. So it seems that even Israel is starting to realize that, you know what, like, do you want Salafists? Because that's how you get Salafists, you know, sort of situation that's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, it's the tough part is when you have Salafists in your neighborhood, things can always get potentially worse in terms of violence and extremism. Like, and for example, it's interesting if you look at the transition of early armed or sort of resistant Palestinian groups, they were oftentimes the earlier ones were blatantly Marxist. As you know, like the PFLP, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, was an admitted secular Marxist group. And those sort of those, for various cocktail of reasons, kind of faded out in prominence from Palestinian society. And then you had Hamas emerge, who were explicitly Sunni Islamists. But these, as I mentioned, Sunni Islamists are nowhere near Salafi jihadis. And it's, of course, whenever an insurgency boils up in any region, its origin is always sociological, and it tends to obey or can be determined by a particular social, political, cultural, historical, etc. cocktail of that region. So I'm not entirely sure of what a potential Salafi jihadi group in Palestine would look like. My guess is they might not have the social ground soil necessary to achieve too much prominence, but I can't blame the Israelis for being wary that something much crazier than Hamas and harder to negotiate could emerge. And I think that's the key part is you can negotiate with Hamas. You might think they're, you know, scummy or dishonest, but they will try to listen to you and within whatever flawed means, try to get some sort of political mobility. If you get jihadis in the region, they will not even listen to you at all. Of course, they will see negotiation or settlement as illegitimate under any context, and you'll just be dealing with a lot of wanton violence. Because as you've noticed, no foreign power will negotiate with ISIS because ISIS has no interest in negotiating.
Right. And, you know, actually, I want to back up a little bit to the point that you alluded to about how early the sort of the early Palestine liberation organization factions, many of which were Marxist and secular, and that sort of evolution. So so my history shows for my audience to give them a little bridge. So we're going to end the show, this series, at the creation of the State of Israel and the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Now, there's a long time between that and the current situation in Gaza. And one of the interesting things is, so you obviously, you had resistance to Zionism under the British Mandate, which mostly came from the notable families, as they are referred to. Wealthy Palestinians, mostly located in the cities, who had accumulated great wealth and owned property, owned businesses. They were the ones who were forming the political parties, the various political factions, and leading the struggle against Zionism. And then once, by the time you get to the 47-49 war, these individual families and political actors become largely irrelevant. Even before the Independence War, many of them, such as the Nashashibis, they end up sort of receding from politics and going more into just focusing on making their money. By the time you get to the 1950s, Palestinian like political resistance to Zionism in Israel basically takes a step back. There's a few individual small groups, you know, going over the border to get to their old farms that are have now been taken over by the Israelis. But for the most part, it is now between Israel and the Arab states. They are the ones who are mainly in conflict. And then when you get to the 1960s, you have this new generation of Palestinians who have may have been born in Palestine and then experienced the Nakba, experienced ethnic cleansing, have experienced what it's like to be in exile. They look to Algeria and they look to the various other examples of anti-national, of nationalist anti-imperialist movements. And that's where the inspiration came from. It was not Islamism in any form. Interestingly enough, many of them do look back to Izzaddin al-Qassam, and I apologize because my pronunciations are suspect at best. Izzaddin al-Qassam, who I'll go into in a later episode, he was an Islamic revivalist who led anti-imperialist struggles against the French and against the British and against the Zionist movement. Before being killed in 1935, they look to him for inspiration, but not in terms of the theoretical, the theological sorts of aspects. They looked to Qassam as a fighter and as someone driving out occupiers and that sort of thing. So in the 1960s, it's some of the most prominent organizations are secular and in many cases, as you mentioned, Marxist, such as the PFLP and the various alphabet soup splinters from the PFLP. And so to bring it to the present, what I find fascinating is that the PLO was public enemy number one for many, many years. They were out to destroy Israel, to drive the Jews into the sea, this, that, and the other thing. And yet by the 1970s, the PLO, the mainstream of the PLO, the leadership, accepted the possibility of recognizing Israel and accepting a two-state solution. This was something that they repeatedly would mention that they were open to negotiating, which led more radical groups within the PLO to be very, very much against, leading to a lot of internal conflicts. The entire time, Israel continues to look at them as public enemy number one. The assault on Lebanon in 1982, I would argue, was not because of any concern for the communities in northern Israel, but because they were concerned that the PLO was increasingly becoming legitimate to the international community. So they needed to destroy them. And then you have the situation in the mid-80s where the Israelis noticed that the Islamists are starting to organize politically, and the Islamists are starting to gain more and more influence, and that the Fatah and the PLO in general are becoming more and more disconnected from the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, and they're starting to get more of a reputation for being corrupt. And it is around that point that Israel starts de facto giving tacit support to, in some cases, individuals who would later go on to form and found Hamas. because it was convenient to them that the PLO was losing the support to these Islamist groups. And of course, by the 90s, Israel starts to realize, like, okay, well, now we're dealing with suicide bombings and these individuals who are extremely radical, who are exacting significant casualties, both on legitimate military targets as well as on illegitimate civilian targets. And then finally, you have a situation where the PLO is so weakened by the various military conflicts it's lost and its increasing marginalization amongst the Palestinian masses, that when Israel is forced to the negotiating table by the First Intifada, Fatah is too weak, the PLO is too weak to really negotiate from a position of strength, and they end up basically becoming a de facto colonial administration for the Israeli government, which a lot of people don't understand. For example, Israel administers collects the taxes for the Palestinian Authority, and whenever the Palestinian Authority starts to reassert its independence, Israel just says, no, no, we're going to withhold your taxes, your tax revenue, so you can't pay anybody until you get back in line. And I look at that situation, and I look at see the situation now, and I see, like, all right, well, like you say, I don't actually think that Salafism has a chance in hell of becoming a major political force in Gaza or in Palestine at large, but we already have a precedent for Israel in its attempts to destroy whoever is seen as the vanguard of the Palestinian national movement, their willingness to empower a more reactionary, less compromising faction. And as you say, Hamas is someone you can talk to. I would not have said that about Hamas back in the day, but in the last decade or so, as they've moderated, I do agree with you on that point. But now it's like, good Lord, what's going to come?
If I can interject, this is what's happened in Israel with the changing nature of the resistance movements in Palestine is reminiscent to me of what occurred in Chechnya. And of course, there's so not neat parallels. I mean, they're very different parts of the world. But initially, when Chechnya tried to break away from the USSR, or the former USSR, now Russian Federation, after the USSR collapsed, the breakaway movements were nationalist and secular. But as time went on and Russia battled viciously to try to retain Chechnya within the territory of the Russian Federation, the Russian authorities targeted the more nationalist or secular movements within the Chechen independence struggle with the greatest military force and violence. And as a result, these movements lost, this area of the Chechen opposition lost power and authority in time. Whereas in tandem with this, Russia tended to turn a blind eye to increasingly intense jihadi or sort of Salafi-esque insurgent groups that were forming in Chechnya, to the point where, as time went on, a group that you could have potentially negotiated with, even though the Russians would have never negotiated, that was more secular, began to lose eminence. And what occurred in the void were sort of the potentially delegitimizing and highly violent Salafi groups that emerged in the aftermath, until there was nothing left of the Chechen opposition but basically Al-Qaeda and now ISIS affiliates. Not saying that's what happened in Israel perfectly, not saying that's, you know, what will happen, but in terms of process and program over a series of years, what can happen is if you basically wear away at a more secular or comparatively, I mean in comparative terms, reasonable group, what remains in the void are those that are most violent, or those that are most extreme.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. Like, you know, I think the end result is probably going to be very different, but it's striking how often when you look at parts of the world that have significant issues with jihadi groups, or at least conservative terrorist problems, that you do have this pattern of whichever force is trying to combat another force, whether it's United States against the Soviet Union, Israel against the Palestine Liberation Organization, or this Chechen example you speak of, you have a similar pattern of creating a more religious, more uncompromising, and more radical alternative to that force that you claimed to be radical and that you claimed that you couldn't negotiate with. Next thing you know, you do end up creating a problem that at least negotiation at least seems unlikely to be successful. Shifting gears here. You have something, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, well, what's interesting too, I mean, this might be a bit of a detour. What's interesting to me is that militarily, Israel does not fear Hamas in a serious way. And it's also been shown that Israel has basically been letting jihadi affiliates park in the Golan Heights for months on end without doing anything, because from purely a military perspective, Israel does not fear Sunni insurgents, but they remain terrified of Hezbollah, who are clearly Shia. So that's a whole other like wrench in the works of this complex equation.
Well, Hezbollah actually knows how to fight, and also, which, I mean, the Gazan militias certainly know how to fight, but unlike them, Hezbollah actually has weapons, legitimately powerful and dangerous weapons. Yeah, could you talk a little bit about that? Because that is actually an aspect of the Syrian war that I've read about, but I don't know a whole lot as to exactly what is going on up in the north between Israel and some of the jihadi groups that the Syrian Arab army has been fighting with.
Okay, well, this is where things get really interesting and murky. As I'd mentioned, there had been jihadi groups basically parked in the Golan Heights for months on end, with Israel doing basically nothing. And this is, of course, comes down to sort of nation-state realpolitik, where Israel knows who its actual geopolitical threat is and knows who its enemy is. Its enemy is, in terms of its major security and military fears, Hezbollah and Iran and their allies and proxies in the Middle East. Those groups are viciously opposed and in conflict with Salafi jihadi groups or Sunni militants. And Israel's policy in Syria has been to basically ignore the Sunni militants around the Golan, and whenever they have the room to do so, launch airstrikes against Hezbollah targets in Syria. Like, again, Israel is a country that is not ever really been all that shy about using military force in neighbor countries if it feels its interests have been threatened. But Israel has been rather quiet on the Golan Heights and rather quiet about a lot of things in Syria, except for hitting targets that are its typical antagonists. Yeah. Basically, sort of making sure they can do what they can to weaken or undermine Hezbollah. And there is a lot of apprehension on the Israeli front. Of course, they tend to sort of their, like any nation state, their focus on the Syrian conflict comes from their particular interests and needs as a political entity. And there is a deep, deep fear in Israel that Hezbollah will basically, when it has enough focus and is away from the Syrian conflict, will again try to push into Israel. And I think you mentioned earlier that the IDF is extremely casualty sensitive, and they are. Mm-hmm. They're sort of the antithesis of a group, again, like Islamic State, that doesn't really care how many fighters it loses.
Yeah.
Israel's defense forces are very, very, very casualty sensitive and sensitive to losing personnel. And Hassan Nasrallah, who is the current head of Hezbollah, once said in a speech, and say what you will about Nasrallah, if you think he's a complete jerk, I wouldn't disagree, but he is a very, very shrewd fellow. And he once said in a speech publicly that, quote, Israel presents a very strong front, but we know that the Zionist state is made of gossamer and cobwebs. Like, there's a deep fear among Hezbollah, who are generally very effective and hardened guerrilla force, or deep fear that Hezbollah, who is a very effective and hardened guerrilla force, will break into Israel sometime, and that will be the next upcoming conflict that breaks out. Because, as we know, the 2006 conflict between Israel and Hezbollah basically ended in a stalemate. And what it comes down to, and this is the sort of thing where it's sort of tough to bring up within a lot of my friend groups who, you know, many of whom have actually spent time in Israel, let alone some of whom spent time serving the IDF, that pound for pound, Hezbollah's fighters are more effective on the ground than the average Israeli soldier often is.
Yeah.
Israel's air force is very, very strong, very effective. But what happened in 2006 in sort of a live demonstration of what a future conflict between the two entities might look like Hezbollah was so disciplined and cohesive and tightly organized that they managed to give Israel a lot of hell on the ground. So Israel basically leaned very heavily on their air force. And air power can be a clear part of a conflict and can be a very important part of military force. But as we've seen with, for example, the Kurds in Syria, you need a strong ground force to basically be the forefront of your any sort of offensive. And the Kurds in Syria and Hezbollah cannot be more different. But what it comes down to, I think, is Israel is most deeply afraid, their defense and security establishment, most deeply afraid of Hezbollah as a guerrilla ground force that might be able to give the IDF much more trouble than they can handle. And that this is coming sooner than some people might expect.
I think what kind of concerns me, because there's many things, many variables up in the air that can go in so many different directions. The one thing I feel confident saying, as you allude to, is that the status quo of Israel and the Palestinians and Hezbollah to the north and that whole situation, it can't continue on like this indefinitely. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's basically you've had a game of basically trying not to escalate things too much while also feeling the need to show strength, to show the other side, hey, we can still mess you up real hard. Whether or not it's true or not, you know, you have, you know, incidents that happen in the north periodically. Hezbollah is very mm-hmm. busy right now and also does not really want to deal with a two-front conflict. But, you know, you do still occasionally have... There was that incident a couple of years ago where they fired... they managed to, like, take out, like several IDF soldiers, took out, like a Humvee or something like that up in the north. Israel retaliated. It was a back and forth. And then everybody went home. And there's that moment every time there's a flare-up, whether it's between Gaza and Israel or Hezbollah and Israel, where it's like, is this going to be it? Is this going to be the time where it gets out of control, where it escalates? And, you know, like in the Gaza case, it's happened three times. It has become that and has escalated. But lately it hasn't. But it's at some point, I wonder what happens when the war in Syria comes to a more or less a conclusion. Which I feel very confident in saying will have some sort of Assad regime still in place, mm-hmm. with Hezbollah now no longer distracted by the war in Syria, and with Israel suddenly feeling like, okay, well, now we can't get away with just going in and reminding them who's boss anymore. Maybe we actually do have to remind them who's boss this time. It just terrifies me, you know, these things that can, you never know when it's going to escalate or not. Every single, and it's normal, every couple of months, there's a rocket fired from Gaza or, you know, a mortar shell falls over from the Golan Heights or something like that. And just knowing that any one of these moments, there could be a massive escalation. And not that it would have mattered under Obama, but certainly... I don't really see Trump being the one to be like, hey, hey, Israelis, you can't do that. It wasn't going to happen under Obama. It's certainly not going to happen under Trump.
Oh, yeah, no. And a lot of the people within Trump's cabinet picks are pretty antagonistic towards Iran. Like, there's a strange ambivalence there. There's obviously a lack of sort of command discipline happening under Trump administration. What a shock. But what we're seeing right now is they're clearly Iran hawks. And then every once in a while, we have a member of the Trump administration come out and say, like, look, we don't want a complete regional escalation. But the weird thing with Trump is I think what's turning out in the immediate is not just pure wanton, you know, Bush the second hawkishness in one direction, but a really scatterbrained policy that kind of pokes at things they probably shouldn't have unless they have a serious plan. You know, like, you don't want to start bombing Shia militias in Syria. I mean, A, that just might not be advised, period. But B, you don't want definitely want to do that unless you consider the potential ramifications and the consequences. So if you have a very strong superpower that's sort of rudderless in a region that it has serious activity in, and then you throw, you know, basically a Molotov cocktail of a Hezbollah, you know, Israel conflict on top of that, who the hell knows where that's going to happen or what's going to happen in that case. And what's interesting, too, is Israel is one of the few states in the region that fears the aftermath of the Syrian civil war, I think, more than it fears the war itself.
Easily, definitely. So let's change gears a bit. I do want to spend a couple of minutes before we conclude. If you could give us a little update on the situation in Mosul a few days ago, the Iraqi government declared victory and the battle in Raqqa is ongoing. If you could give us a quick little update on what's the situation going on there.
Yeah, I mean, the fight to retake Mosul has been, as is the case with an insurgent conflict like this, unimaginably brutal. ISIS, of course, is a, you know, bit off way more than they could chew during a time of severe and pretty much unprecedented, sort of civil fracture and political instability and post-conflict just general chaos to capture a lot of territory in Sunni-dominant Iraq. Now that they are as cohesive opposition against them, they've basically folded like an origami crane. And the combination of the Iraqi army, a national army that's been reformed and trained, and the Peshmerga from the KRG, the Kurdish Peshmerga, have broken, sort of surrounded them in Mosul, and in a very grinding procedural district-by-district way, have gone in and basically killed every ISIS fighter they could. They surrounded the city to the point where no ISIS fighters could easily escape unless they somehow managed to, you know, shave off their, you know, long hair and their beard and try to blend in with civilians. But yeah, it's there's a lot of destruction. The Trump administration is way less sensitive to or attentive to than civilian casualties in the Obama administration. So Mosul is basically, this is, you know, way too simplified. It's not entirely happening like this. To a point, is being flattened so it can be saved. And ISIS, of course, is collapsing. There's not a whole lot of them left holed up in Mosul. We're at a point where, you know, the destruction of Mosul has been pretty rampant. A lot of it just blown to bits for the sake of getting rid of ISIS. And what we're seeing in a broad scope with ISIS in, you know, their splotch of terrain that's stretched across Syria and Iraq is they're basically almost retracting into the area from which they first originated. They spread out, you know, dangerously into sort of northern Syria and into the Kurdish territory, and those are the areas they lost the most. Now they've sort of shrunk in a bit further to places like Mosul and Raqqa. Those are being knocked as well. Mosul and Raqqa are both predominantly Sunni Arab cities, but even those are being taken from ISIS, and it's almost like watching a caliphate happen in reverse. Like, ISIS originated from an insurgency in Anbar province in western Iraq, which is, again, a very rural, sort of hinterlands, sort of Sunni tribal territory. And what will likely happen is once ISIS is driven from Mosul and Raqqa, you will see them, with time, shrink back into the area from which they originated and from which they might be hardest to dislodge. And I don't mean they'll put up a military resistance. I mean in the sense that they will probably, in the long term, scatter and dissipate as a smaller guerrilla or insurgent movement that is able to stay underground or at least stay out of sight now that they're being, you know, completely eviscerated as a conventional military force.
I have a question. So I know in the past you talked about how leading up to the attacks on Mosul and Raqqa, that you were expecting that there would be an uptick in terror attacks in Europe and North America and elsewhere in the world from ISIS-inspired or ISIS-linked individuals. I want to hear if you think that that turns out to have been the case, which I get the impression it has been. And two, I don't remember if the attacks in that happened in the UK leading up to the election there, I don't remember if any of those were confirmed to have been ISIS-linked. I imagine they have to have at least been somewhat inspired by. But I wanted to hear your thoughts on what appears to be ISIS's strategy of trying to inspire attacks in other countries, and whether or not you think their intended goals of radicalizing people against Muslims or to affect elections, and whether it's in France or in the UK, whether or not they've had any success at that, or what your thoughts are.
Yeah, that's a very good question and a very complicated one. I mean, my general thesis, one that has not changed for the past, you know, God, 3 years at this point, is that ISIS are reckless and optimistic, but in terms of their concept of grand cohesive strategy, are complete morons. like their comprehension of how to sort of manage a greater campaign towards an outcome or goal is, you know, not exactly among the strategic grades of history. But you are correct about the fact that ISIS or ISIS-inspired individuals have perpetrated a small uptick in attacks ever since ISIS started to collapse. Like, for example, it's interesting, the attacks in Paris, the one where the militants shot up basically civilians out enjoying themselves, including at the Eagles of Death Metal concert, that happened pretty much coincidental to a humiliating defeat in Sinjar, Iraq. And subsequently, you saw the subway or transportation bombings in Belgium. You've seen individuals who sweared some sort of affiliation to ISIS causing truck attacks, and also the Manchester bombing in the Ariana Grande concert. But the interesting part about those are only a fraction of the amount of sort of civilian-targeted mass casualty attacks ISIS has been perpetrating, because it's harder to direct and network those kind of attacks in Europe, even much more difficult to do so in America. What they're focusing on right now is the unspoken sectarian goal that sort of Western pundits often forget. ISIS has been focusing much more heavily on basically trying to slaughter or kill Shia Arabs or Shia in general throughout Iraq and Syria or neighboring countries. I believe if you go back to the bombing in Lebanon, I think the majority of those targeted were either Christians or Shia Arabs. There was the parliament attack in Iran that was carried out by an ISIS affiliate there. And when all said and done, what's interesting about ISIL is that they are, in terms of at least their surface ideology, are religious fantasists. The caliphate is a fantasy. It's, say, for example, like negotiating a territorial expansion or territorial lines is a very cohesive, modern, pragmatic, sensible, strategic goal. If your goal is to basically herald some sort of eschatological outcome where there's a caliphate and an end times battle, and everyone is converted by the sword, or in this case, a Kalashnikov, you're dealing with some really bizarre, nebulous potential outcomes, considering that's something that will never actually happen. So what ISIS seems to be falling back on, as I've mentioned, is basically killing those they perceive as heretics, which in this case comes down to be Shia Muslims. And of course, since both the Syrian regime is headed by Shia Alawites and Iran is the sort of really only Shia-dominant country in the world, and these are not people that the American diplomatic establishment is friendly to, we don't really hear, nor do our politicians care all that much about Shia Muslims being killed. And that's kind of what that bit comes down to. In terms of ISIS's potential goal in inspiring or attempting to radicalize those in other countries, we'll see how that pans out. Even among Sunni Muslims, ISIS is not particularly popular. And the only, I can see the only place it could be going is ISIS using its brand name, a sort of general, broad, nebulous brand name to support insurgencies elsewhere. We've seen that sort of kind of weird flare up in the Philippines, where a group that claims allegiance to ISIS has sort of been kicking up dust in the Muslim-dominant parts of the world. I think what will happen is, in the long game, ISIS will shrink back into Anbar province, Iraq. And if there is a possibility of social fracture and an exploitable situation, ISIL will do, again, what it did during the beginning of its insurgency, which is harass locals, basically bother local security forces, assassinate figureheads, and try to foment chaos. Basically, wherever there is chaos, an easily exploitable chaos, something that can be instigated merely by provoking violence, you will likely see a potential Salafi jihadi insurgency at least attempt to emerge. And where that'll happen next, I don't know. I have a pet theory we're going to see Chechnya go up in flames next, or at least more activity there, but again, who knows? Wherever there's instability and opportunity, a group like ISIS will, you know, stick its head on the ground.
Well, man, this is a cheerful topic.
it's what I specialize in. You know, I'm glad to, you know, come on your show, you know, spread happiness.
You know, I didn't come prepared with a funny thing to talk about towards the end, like last time when I was like, all right, we're going to talk about some heavy stuff, so let's make sure we get to Piss Big Granddad. I don't have an equivalent of that today, unfortunately. So before we wrap up, is there any last thoughts that you had or anything else that you didn't have a chance to talk about?
Yeah, I wish I had a good limerick about ISIS or something, but I just don't. yeah, no, in terms of other topics, I feel this covers it pretty thoroughly. Yeah, I mean, what's going to be interesting to watch, and I sort of, for any of your listeners who are interested in following the Middle East, I strongly encourage anyone just to keep an eye on what happens in Syria as sort of the next course of action. Because Syria's political situation is kind of hard to predict, but it's going to get very complicated very soon, because you have...
Wait, it's not already? You mean it's going to get worse? Good Lord.
It's going to get worse in its own special way. Insofar as in the northeast, you have the Kurds and Kurdish allied forces have eked out a pretty serious territorial victory and driven out ISIS. In the west, the Assad regime has, at considerable cost, asserted itself, whereas the Sunni opposition, the non-ISIS Sunni opposition that encompasses secularists to hardline jihadi groups, has, you know, been beaten back pretty thoroughly. And ISIS is, of course, just crumbling. And so you have a country where the majority population is Sunni Arab, but any ostensibly Sunni Arab force has no cachet anymore. And you basically have the Kurds on one end, Assad on the other, a pissed off Turkey, and a United States that doesn't really know what it wants. And that's things are not going to simmer down anytime soon. It's just the conflict will emerge into something else. That wasn't cheery enough. I apologize.
Word.
But yeah, either way, you know, if anyone is, of your listeners, like I said, looks into that part of the world, keep an eye on that.
Next time, I spent all this time getting ready for this episode by refreshing on my like last 10 years of history on Gaza and other related items that didn't occur to me to think of something funny to say. So, hey, everybody listening to this, I apologize. Next
Just
time.
A side note, Kenny, do you want to do like a comedy episode one time?
Oh, of course. Well, we'd have to actually come up with something that could be funny. That's the topic needs to be funny. Otherwise, it's just going to be really depressing and such.
Yeah, I'm afraid my subject area doesn't exactly lead itself to, you know, knee slapping humor. But I can try.
I know I'm talking to somebody about maybe doing an episode later on to actually talk about like a real topic. But I found out that this dude apparently also is really, really into pro wrestling. And like, I haven't watched pro wrestling since I was a wee one. But I mean, if we want to talk about major influences on my life as an artist and other respects, WWE in the 90s, particularly the Attitude Era, before it was WWE, very important. I mean, you know, it was also an incredibly horrifically misogynistic, sexist, aggressive, you know, masculine, whatever era in an already misogynistic and toxically masculine genre of entertainment. But man, was it good theater. Like, as performers, as actors, as improvisers, I actually really respect what those dudes do. So yeah, so I'm hoping maybe like we'll be able to do like a de facto leftist analysis of pro wrestling or something like that.
That would be cool. As a small addendum to what you just mentioned about the theater of pro wrestling, you may have caught this. There was happened a little while back earlier this year. There was a American who goes and wrestles in, remind me, the Mexican pro wrestling theater. It's Lucha Libre.
Something like that. I should know that. I really should.
Well, this dude is an American who goes down there and plays a villain in the pro wrestling circuit who is a unabashedly jingoistic Trump supporter. He goes into the ring with like an American flag with Trump's face plastered on it, and the Mexicans down there just love just, you know, hissing at this guy. And he's somehow managed to make a considerable career in Mexico playing a villainous Trump supporter. Who eventually, you know, gets, of course, beaten down by a sort of proud, unapologetic, sort of quasi-nationalistic Mexican figure. And it's all the intersection between, you know, political theater and pro wrestling theater is less far than you think.
No, I'm with you. That makes so much sense. All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Adam. We'll have you again sometime soon.
Absolutely. It's always great, Kenny.
Adam maintains a blog called napalminthemorning.com. and writes for currentaffairs.org. You can reach him on Twitter at AdamPattersonDC or contact him via email at napalminthe@gmail.com. Yes, yes, The Movements is a left-wing history and politics podcast. Music by Reem Bana. Support the show by donating at paypal.me/movementspodcast Subscribe on Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod. More information on movements.buzzsprout.com. Betulira